You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an environmental activist tells us how her six-year sailing journey on the Atlantic Ocean helped her come to terms with living in a world facing climate change.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Tuesday, U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher's constituents in Green Bay held a town hall event knowing the lawmaker wasn't going to be there.
Robert Mentzer joins us now for the details of that story and other top news from the week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to look at some of the week's biggest news. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
So why did a group of residents in northeastern Wisconsin have this congressional town hall without the congressional representative?
Well, I mean, you got to, you know, they recorded their messages. They're going to send them to their elected representatives. So Congress was off this week, and in these recesses is often a time when people want to meet with their members of Congress, and it's normal for Congress members to hold town halls or public events when they're on recess. But on this recess, there have been conspicuously few of those in Wisconsin or anywhere in the country, and it seems to be an intentional strategy by Republicans to try to counteract some of the headlines and some of the viral videos that came at town hall meetings earlier this year when constituents were angry about the health care bill and were yelling at their representatives about the consequences of these policies they're working on. So in the absence of a Gallagher town hall, about 100 constituents in the Green Bay area showed up and had one without him.
And so what came out of that?
So, I mean, this is, you know, it's a piece of political theater. I don't say that as a value judgment, but this is a tactic, right? So mostly these are, you know, folks of a liberal persuasion who wanted to talk about the American Health Care Act, the Obamacare repeal, and so would give, you know, the sort of emotional testimony that is, you know, that is everywhere right now about, you know, my daughter has pre-existing conditions. I lost my job and could lose my health care and other things to really underline the consequences of that bill. And so, you know, they hope that, you know, this is not the first time that organizers have held sort of these empty chair town halls. And in February, also in Green Bay, there was they invited U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and held a town hall meeting without him. And so it's kind of a, you know, it's a way to try to show, you know, put some emphasis on these issues, sort of with or without the elected representative.
And in Representative Gallagher's case, his office had said he held a phone town hall, a conference call town hall. Is that right?
Yeah, sure. And that's, I mean, you know, that is a tool. Sometimes you'll hear Congress people try to say that, well, you can actually reach more people and it's more convenient. But, I mean, who are they kidding, right? I mean, you're missing something when it's not the sort of face-to-face interaction at a telephone town hall. It's nothing like the same level of immediacy.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some top Wisconsin news from the past week. A lot going on in the legislature lately, Rob. This week, a bill creating tougher penalties for University of Wisconsin student protesters advanced out of an assembly committee. What would this bill do exactly?
Yeah, so this would require the University of Wisconsin to take disciplinary action against students who disrupt speeches on campus, and also would mandate that the UW itself stay neutral on topics of political controversy. So it's a little bit hard to know how likely this is to actually become law. It passed out of an assembly committee, so it may or may not get a vote in the full assembly. It may or may not then be passed by the state senate. But it's still interesting, just in the sense that it fits into the sort of culture war around campus speech and campus norms.
Yeah, this comes in the backdrop of people paying a lot of attention to cases where protesters on campus had, one way or another, disrupted speakers, conservative speakers, in a lot of the right. examples given. One case here on the UW-Madison campus, for example. What are Republicans saying about the need for this kind of change to protect these speakers?
Right.
Well, that's exactly it, right? I mean, there is these things are not they're not made up. These cases really have existed. They have happened in Wisconsin, where you know, a student group invites a conservative speaker to campus, and then another group of liberal students determines that this speaker is beyond the pale in some way, and so either disrupts the event or shouts down the speaker. You know, the case in Wisconsin was fairly muted. There was some sort of heckling and some protests, and then they left, and then the speech went on. But there have been cases elsewhere in the country where people, you know, I don't know, pull a fire alarm or really, like, prevent someone from even entering a lecture hall. And so, you know, this is something that the conservative media, Fox News and talk radio and so on, they love to talk about these cases of student protests and sort of try to paint the portrait that this is indicative of the left, and they'll shout you down. It's political correctness out of control. And so this bill by a Republican legislator is an attempt to sort of capitalize on that strain of argument.
And how have Democrats reacted?
Well, I mean, the main thing is, it's a bit of a weird thing for the legislature to get involved with. UW leaders say, on its face reasonably, that universities already have campus rules in place to punish students who disrupt events. It doesn't require a state law to make that happen. And the Board of Regents has already made it the official policy of the university to support the free exchange of ideas, even those that might be considered offensive or out of the norm. So their case, and that's the, you know, Democrats would echo that case largely, is that this is really like meddling from the legislature for something that is, you know, it does not require the state to get involved.
Right. The state would mandate, you touched on this briefly, a fairly substantial punishment potentially for someone, especially if they're repeat violators. We're talking suspension for a term, expulsion after a few incidents.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, a few incidents, that's not necessarily unreasonable. If a student is like repeatedly pulling a fire alarm on some speaker, you know, all right, maybe that student should be expelled. But the question really is whether that's something that the state assembly should be deciding, or if it's more for the university itself to manage how it disciplines and deals with students who violate rules. I mean, there is an existing rule that they are violating when they do that.
And finally, some news about spelling in Wisconsin, apparently. There's the big spelling bee this week, of course. So Google Trends released each state's most searched how to spell words. So when people go online, apparently say, how do I spell blank? They tell you what the top word is in each state. And the state in Wisconsin that we're asking how to spell, or the word we're asking how to spell, is Wisconsin.
Right. I mean, listen, it's a little bit of a tricky word. Have you never made a typo on Wisconsin? I have. I guess, though, it's a typo. Like, I do know how to spell it when that happens. But so, I don't know. I mean, this is so fun. This is, like, irresistible, this map, to look at what the most frequently, I don't know if it's most frequently misspelled word or just the most frequently, maybe the better way to say it is the most frequently inquired word in each state. And so this made the rounds. Wisconsin does have the distinction of being the only state where the state name is that most common search term. Now, the Mississippians, they know how to spell their name.
Right, but you think Connecticut, Massachusetts, I got to think about those myself.
Right. Yeah, Connecticut. Come on, that's a tricky one. Connecticut actually was one of my favorites because Connecticut and West Virginia, each their most common string was how to spell supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. So there's not a lot that unites Connecticut and West Virginia, but a love of Mary Poppins is one thing that does.
And Rob, is there a word as we wrap up that you have trouble with that makes you have to reach for the dictionary? Online or otherwise.
So many words. I subscribe to the view that if you stare at any word for long enough, it appears misspelled. Like it doesn't, the word leg, if you really look at it, looks wrong, will start to look wrong. So I definitely, again, I call it a typo, but I certainly am guilty of, I type, Wisconsin wrong probably multiple times a day, but I like to think I catch it then when I do.
Mine, I have to try a couple times. Entrepreneur, Caribbean, Mediterranean. Those are, I'm never going to get them right on the first try.
Those are good. Those are good.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us, no matter how you spell Wisconsin.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to look back at the week's biggest state news.
Heather Lynn Mann was in despair about climate change. She was working as an environmental advocate in Madison, and at the time, she was at the end of her rope.
So she and her husband decided to take a break and spent some time on a small sailboat in the Atlantic Ocean. Along the way, they met danger and overcame challenges. Ultimately, they walked away with a new understanding about the natural world and the resiliency required to live in it.
Heather Lynn Mann writes about her time at sea in the new book, Ocean of Insight, A Sailor's Voyage from Despair to Hope. And she joins us now. Heather, welcome to Central Time.
Well, good afternoon.
Why did you decide to give up your job at the time this was in Madison, Wisconsin, and spend a few years sailing the Atlantic Ocean?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, my husband and I, when we were first dating 30 years ago, we used to walk hand in hand through no trespassing signs at the marinas near where we lived. And neither one of us sailed, but we were drawn to the boats and the rigging. And I think we fell in love with the idea of sailing away someday, at the same time that we fell in love with each other. So many years later, when he came home and said, "I think we've saved enough money for a sabbatical, 5 years, do you want to go?" I said yes. And at that point, I was deep into a career as an environmental advocate based out of Madison, Wisconsin, and working throughout the state, even doing some consulting work at the federal level on climate policy. And I thought long and hard about whether I needed to go because, you know, as a activist, you don't just let yourself off the hook to go sail over the horizon. So I decided I'd take with me a question. And that was, how am I to be in a suffering world? And I would take that question straight to nature. And I suspected that I'd hear a different answer than if I had stayed in embedded in society.
Did you already know how to sail when you took on this boat?
We had had many years of sailing in Lakes Mendota and Monona, and we had chartered boats in the Caribbean and in the Great Lakes. But it turns out what we didn't really know what we didn't know, and we got into all kinds of trouble when we set sail.
You know, and it sounds like you also felt uncertain about your lives, your settled lives in Madison. You'd done all the things that you felt like a person was kind of supposed to do in their life, but it didn't feel right. Were you able at the time to put your finger on why that was?
Well, yes. And the biggest thing that was troubling me was I had the Center for Resilient Cities, and we were doing work in urban neighborhoods in Milwaukee and Madison and elsewhere, and we would buy contaminated land and clean it up and then partner with local residents to really turn these landscapes into places of vitality and beauty. And I knew that that was really rewarding and important work, but there was this thing called climate change that the world just didn't seem to be addressing head on. And the projections kept getting more and more frightening. And I did something, but I had no idea what.
And it ended up being this question that you took to nature about how to live in a world with climate change. And it sounds like during these first weeks and months on the boat, a lot of stuff went wrong. And it took you a while to figure, I'm probably understating it. Things broke all the time. There were moments, but you weren't really afraid until this one particular moment that you write about. The first time you were really afraid that you could end up dying and your boat could crash. Can you tell us about, briefly, what happened that time in I think it was Tulu Cay?
Yeah, Tulu Cay was in the Bahamas, and it was New Year's Eve. And we had actually been sailing for a few years. On this particular night, a storm was building up. I had misjudged the direction of the wind, and as it was blowing, it was pushing us toward the shore rather than away from the shore. So we were backing up slowly because our anchors were refusing to grab the bottom, backing up slowly to very sharp rocks that were about hull height. And I realized that I was about to have those rocks puncture my hull, and I'd probably hurt myself. My husband would get injured while we were trying to do this rescue. And there was no one able to come to give us a tow out from this situation, and we couldn't sail ourselves out from this hole we had dug ourselves in. So this was really indeed the first time when I was deeply frightened. And I noticed that when I was frightened, I was really bad crew. I found my thoughts were coming really slowly, and I was having a hard time even knowing what to do. And at this one moment, you know, close to midnight, I was supposed to be shining a light spotlight behind me every 15 minutes to see if we absolutely had to do something, that we had lost significant ground. And I knew my husband would be up shortly, and so I stopped looking. And when he came up and I told him that I had done that, I instantly knew that I had let myself down, that I had made a decision to be there. This was my boat. It was my responsibility. And what I realized was that I needed to get a grip of my fear. And actually, this is a really good story because it also illuminates what happens to me as an environmental activist, is that when I am deeply afraid, I am lousy crew and I don't think straight, and I can't be nearly as effective as when I'm calm and stable and purposeful in my actions. And so there's this ancient, you know, I'm a Buddhist practitioner, and I was looking at these events that were happening at sea through the lens of Eastern philosophy, and I realized that there was this practice called Tonglen, where I could breathe in sensation of my fear, and I could breathe out compassion for myself. And as soon as I did that, I transformed the situation from an energy that was harmful and that I couldn't, you know, difficult to deal with, into an energy that was safe and that I could move through. So with compassion, then I was able to start thinking and mobilizing, and indeed we live to tell about it on another day.
Heather Lynn Mann is with us right now. She's the founder of the not-for-profit Center for Resilient Cities and the author of Ocean of Insight, A Sailor's Voyage from Despair to Hope. And Heather, we were just talking about fear. You experienced it sailing. You got in a frightening spot. You got out of it, but you had to figure out a way to deal with fear. And in your book, you're also coming face-to-face with living with fear in the face of climate change, which is something that's not unique to you. There are many people who have fears about the future, fears about what's going to happen. What did you come away with about how to look that in the face? And as you would say, be good crew. Keep your head on straight.
Well, that's part of it. And, you know, I think that what has been happening in the news in the last 24 hours is really relevant to this question. And the fact that the book, Ocean of Insight, came out actually on Election Day. You know, many people have seen this as a real challenge, this administration, and now with backing out of the climate agreement that was set in Paris, there's people that are feeling a lot of strong emotions about that. And what I would say is that, you know, what came very clear to me is that this climate challenge is not just a political or a scientific or a technological or even an economic crisis. It's a spiritual crisis. And a lot of the roots that have been growing, that have brought us to this point, have been based in greed, you know, the greed not only of individuals, but of our corporations and financial institutions and our politicians. It's so embedded in society, and fear about all kinds of economic security, and a delusion even that we're perceiving ourselves as completely separate from the natural world, that we as humans can survive and thrive. It doesn't really matter what's happening to the environment. And these spiritual roots of greed and fear and delusion, there are ways of looking at them, conquering them in ourselves, and also supporting others in our community to conquer them. So it's not okay that we are writing off other nations. It's not okay that we're writing off other landscapes or species. We really are interdependent. And part of a spiritual awakening is to see that interdependence and start taking responsibility and offering care to the natural world, and not as a factor of being guilted into it, but as a way of really seeing our interdependence and that our success depends on the success of others as well.
Now, as we wrap up, just a little bit of time left, but not everyone can do a six-year voyage on a boat. Are there other ways that people can, as you say, come face-to-face with nature and maybe come away with that same sense you have of being interconnected?
Absolutely. And this would be a terrible book if it was just the prescription for everybody to go sailing. Really, what it comes down to is that nature is everywhere and that even our own bodies and minds are a part of nature. And that it is not other and outside of ourselves, but that if we take moments of quiet reflection, either through meditation or prayer, you know, whatever it is that is your spiritual background, you can come to a place of feeling connected with earth or with creation. And that awakening then is a shift that goes from seeing the earth as a commodity and resources as a commodity into something that we are very grateful for. And that as soon as we water the seeds of gratitude, suddenly we are in a world of abundance and we are not alone and we can react and interact with the world around us in a way that is much more harmonious and satisfying and rewarding.
Heather, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate being able to share Ocean of Insight.
Heather Lynn Mann is the author of the new book, Ocean of Insight, A Sailor's Voyage from Despair to Hope. In the book, she tells a story of how her six-year journey on the Atlantic Ocean shaped the way she thinks about the natural world and about climate change. Many families in Wisconsin are dealing with the cost of long-term care for seniors or are worried about the potential for high costs in the future.
According to a new survey from the Associated Press, only about a third of older Americans have saved any money for long-term care expenses, and only 15% of those surveyed say they're extremely confident or very confident that they can afford those expenses.
Many people expect Medicare coverage to pay for significant costs, but while Medicare can help with direct medical treatment costs, it doesn't generally cover the kinds of assistance people may need in performing daily tasks when they're suffering serious health impairments.
Christine Bishop joins us now. She's an economist and professor at the Heller School at Brandeis University. She was a senior staff member on a U.S. Senate commission on long-term care in 2013. Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm so pleased to be here. Wherever I go as an economist, if I'm just talking with people, everyone has a story about trying to make long-term care work for someone in their family. And the economics of this are really important.
Well, yeah, and the origin of wanting to talk about this, I was talking to a group of WPR listeners in their 60s and 70s a month or so ago, and a lot of them had stories about the cost of care for their parents, and they were worried about their own situation in the years to come. How big an issue is this nationwide?
Well, we are spending a lot as a nation and a society on this issue. We use a lot of resources for long-term services and supports for older adults. Currently, there are about 7 million people who are receiving these services, and it's well over $200 billion. And the nursing home is likely what you think of first. That serves about 1.5 million people. We have assisted living and paid home services, and all of these are very expensive. But the biggest cost is the time and effort of family and friends, informal caregivers and who are spouses and adult children and friends, and they're not paid, so sometimes they're thought of as free care, but this is also a huge resource for our care needs.
And this is something that can be really hard to prepare for. And you mentioned this to me when we chatted briefly yesterday. Some people are going to need a lot of expensive care. Some people are going to need almost nothing, and you don't know which it's going to be for you. So how do you start to prepare for something like that?
Absolutely. The burden of costs of the need for care doesn't fall evenly, and it's about half of all people who turn 65 who will not need substantial long-term services and supports in their remaining lifetime. But at the high end of this need, there are about 14% of people will spend more than 5 years with a pretty high level of need where they'll need care from a family member or paid care. And this is a very variable expense, and it's very hard to prepare for as an individual or as a family. It's really a problem.
And people often think, it sounds like, that Medicare is going to cover a lot of the costs, and that may be true for very specific medical parts of care. But when we're talking about a person with some kind of impairment where they need help, you know, living day to day, that is generally, as I understand it, not covered by Medicare.
That's absolutely true, that the Medicare program was designed for acute health needs. It does cover chronic health needs. If you need skilled nursing after a hospital admission, Medicare will cover a certain number of days, and it will cover some home health, but it does not cover care if what you need is help with function. Everyday tasks of daily living become difficult for people with functional impairment, and help with eating, with getting around, with dressing, with grooming, with getting to the bathroom are just not covered by Medicare.
Talking to Christine Bishop from Brandeis University, looking at the costs of long-term care for seniors. Christine, let's look at that institutional situation now. Somebody who needs more or less around-the-clock care, or at least access to that. Can you talk about how big a financial burden that can be for people?
Well, the average cost of a private room in a nursing home is well over $200 a day. And so people who do need nursing home care go into the nursing home, and they can spend all of their assets quite quickly on that. So in many states, Medicaid will take care of people who become poor as well as those who are poor. Medicaid is designed originally as a program to assist people without means, but middle-class people can go into a nursing home and spend their assets and their income on the cost of care, and then go onto Medicaid. So that's really why Medicaid covers so much of our nursing home care in this country. If you look at the total amount of nursing home care for that's really long-term care, it's 63% that Medicaid covers. And looking at that from the other side, by the way, that's a huge burden for states, that states are challenged to come up with a budget to take care of people who are in nursing homes and have become or are Medicaid eligible.
And we have a thing called long-term care insurance that people can buy. Is that working as a solution?
Well, that was very promising about 20 years ago. I was very excited about it because it seemed to be an answer to sharing these burdens across more people, pooling across people. And people started to buy it, and it seemed to work very well. They assess people for need, and the insurance can kick in. It covers people now for care at home. And we did a study that found that people with this insurance were able to stay home at quite a high level of need for a longer period of time than people without this insurance, because they were getting some help with costs for home care. Currently, the insurance companies are having a lot of challenges with this, and we're finding them walking away from this business. I mean, anyone who's purchased insurance will have that covered. There is a promise to keep going with the insurance, but they aren't writing new policies at the rate that they were. So this does not seem to be working so well, and people have called it a niche market, that it's maybe designed for quite upper middle income people who can pay the high premiums.
Let's look at the cost side of things now. Is it the case that, whether we're talking institutional care or hired home health care, are those things too costly now? Or is it just a fact that these are expensive things that to provide these services?
We don't see the kind of waste and abuse and so on that is alleged for our medical system. We don't see super high fees because it's a very competitive market. Medicaid pays at a pretty low rate in many places, and when the private payer is involved, they're going to shop for care. And so I don't think we've got waste and abuse here. We do have a basic fundamental issue that long-term services and supports requires hands-on care from another person, real services from an individual who is going to help the client, the person with the needs. And that means that as our economy keeps going and productivity goes up in other areas, we are going to have to pay these people a wage to draw them into the market. And I would even say we are not paying them enough now. So it's not as if these things are overly expensive or luxurious.
Let's talk about those workers a bit. We've talked about that here in Wisconsin. People who do home health care, various forms of nurses' assistants, other jobs at the lower levels are, I think, notoriously low-paying here and around the country. Why is that?
I think there's a feeling with a lot of so-called care work that anybody can do it. And I would argue a bit differently, that people who are drawn into this field are really using their caring and emotional resources and ought to be compensated for that. They really are getting to know their clients, their residents, and how they like to be taken care of. And when we have high turnover in that field, either on a nursing home unit or for the person that's coming to a home to take care of an older adult, all that knowledge is lost, and a new person comes in the next day and starts with care that can be very intimate and so on. So I've been doing studies to try to find out how these jobs are organized, how we could make them better jobs so that people would feel more respected and valued. And part of it will be higher wages.
We're talking about the cost of long-term senior care with Christine Bishop from the Heller School at Brandeis University.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue that you're dealing with in your family, or you're worried about it maybe in the near future? What kind of costs are you seeing, and how are you covering that? Are you providing free senior care for a family member, and how is that affecting your life? If you work in senior care, what are you seeing there? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the cost of long-term care for seniors. Christine Bishop is with us. She's a professor at the Heller School at Brandeis University.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue for you and your family? Are you dealing with the costs of providing long-term care for yourself or a member of your family? Are you paying for institutional care? How is that going? Or are you providing care yourself? If you work at a care provider, we'd like to hear your perspective on these issues as well. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Christine, before we go to our callers, you were on a commission a few years back looking at solutions. What kind of solutions are out there to this fairly complicated issue?
Well, the fundamental issue, I would say, for our society and our politics is that this has been seen as an individual and family responsibility, and it's hard to move the needle to get people to think about sharing it across many people. That can be done through private insurance, of course, but I believe we need to have some kind of public program that's going to make sure that people are sharing these costs. And that was the fundamental divide on this commission, which was made up of representatives appointed by both the Democratic and the Republican sides of our Congress. There are some ways of dealing with this that we see abroad, where Germany and and Japan and some other countries really have made this a part of their social insurance scheme to make sure that there is a basic level of long-term services and supports that people will have access to.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joya is with us in Fitchburg. Joya, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I went through this experience for 3 years. My husband had a Parkinson's disease. He passed away from Parkinson's disease 2 years ago. And he wanted to pass away at home, so I had to arrange for the home caregiver and with the local agencies. And when I interviewed them, they said, you know, we'll send two people, you know, on a consistent basis. And but you know, in reality, they send me more than six people, because of the two people, one person could not come. They sent somebody totally new who did not know how to take care of the person. And, you know, I had to stay awake at night and to take care of him. And number one, for that, they would not deduct any money, though, that the person was incompetent caregiver.
Joya, thanks for the call. Very sorry for that difficult situation and for your loss. But, Christine, there it is. Hard to get reliable services, Joya's saying, and that issue of turnover. Ideally, you'd like to have the same people coming to provide that care.
Absolutely. And we should be thinking more carefully about what the jobs are like for these people and making sure they have good orientation and training and enough pay and benefits to find it worthwhile to stick with the job.
Joya, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Diane with us in Sheboygan. Diane, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to make the comment that I've been working in the senior care industry for like 23 years, and I've been an administrator in assisted living. And I always make the comparison. My husband works at Miller Brewing Company, and we pay brewery workers almost $30 an hour to make beer in Wisconsin. Yet we pay our caregivers like $9 an hour to care for our seniors. And that just, I think, is just kind of exemplifies, you know, the thought process of the state, well, across the country, really.
Diane, thanks for the call. $9 an hour, she says, for caregivers in assisted living. Is this an issue of priorities, Christine?
It also is a kind of market situation. People will do this work for $9, but they can't afford almost to have the kind of commitment that we would see from the beer workers. I'd be curious to do a comparative study of those manufacturing workers versus the assisted living workers, and the amount of knowledge that people build up on the job is probably similar, even though it's about different subjects, obviously.
Thanks for that call, Diane. We're talking to Christine Bishop from Brandeis University. She researches long-term care for seniors, and that's the issue we're talking about, the costs of caring for seniors. You can join us at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Judith on the line in Spooner. Judith, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I was making the point that when you do have private pay, you tend to be gouged because you have to be paying for those low returns on Medicaid. And because there's such a high percentage of Medicaid patients, I'm paying over $12,000 a month for my mother to be in a long-term care facility. And when her money's gone, then she will go on Medicaid. But they try and make up their loss by private pay and, in essence, gouging people. And every month I learn something new, and recently learned that doesn't even cover her medication. I have to pay that separate. So I'll just leave it there.
Judith, thanks for the call, and good luck in dealing with that situation. Christine, is that the case? Medicaid, low reimbursement rates. So if I'm operating a facility, I'm saying at least I'm not making a lot on Medicaid patients. I have to charge more for people paying out of pocket?
Well, the, the nursing homes, in order to stay open, they are facing what economists would call a two-part market. And the theory would say that they're charging they won't take Medicaid patients unless they are paying at least their additional costs. But it's likely that the private pay residents are covering the overhead costs, so that you do see different prices for these two parts of the market. It's interesting that the private pay residents have, many of them, migrated toward assisted living. So nursing homes are having a tough time staying open. They're closing in our state here in Massachusetts, and there's just been a shift in the market. So, again, I think we need to think about a total public policy toward this, so that the people who really need nursing home care will have it there for them when they need it.
So you're saying we need to think about a public policy, but are we thinking about public policy on this? We hear a lot of the debate over, you know, the health care, the Affordable Care Act, the American Health Care Act. Are people even treating this as a policy issue?
Painfully, for someone who's been working on this for many years, this has been on the back burner in recent years, partly because of how important solving our health insurance situation has been. And we do need to solve the health insurance issues first. But there are groups in Washington who are trying to get together in a bipartisan way and think about how we should be financing long-term care. So there is some hope on the horizon, I would say.
And is this something that states could be doing at the local level, basic inaction from the federal government?
Absolutely. Hawaii actually came very close to passing a statewide long-term care program that would help residents of Hawaii. Now, they're a little different because they're sort of isolated. I mean, you can imagine what the issues are for states where people could migrate in and out to get a better long-term care deal. But states may have to step up on this and be the lead on it.
Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That was Christine Bishop, economist and professor at the Heller School at Brandeis University. She was a senior staff member on a U.S. Senate Commission on Long-Term Care in 2013, and she joined us for a look at the ongoing costs of long-term care for seniors. Still time for you to share your thoughts and experiences over at the Central Time Facebook page.